Hello everyone, and thanks for joining us on this East Africa Food Crisis call. My name is Kat Carter and I'm the Emergency Comms Manager here at Save the Children. I'm joined by Gareth Owen, our Humanitarian Director, Andrew Wonder, who is currently in Habaswain, which is in northeast Kenya. And as a surprise, we also have Justin Forsyth on the line, who is our Chief Executive and who is also in northeast Kenya. So thanks very much for joining me. Gareth, we've all seen the terrible pictures coming out of East Africa. Can you give us a quick overview of the situation?
Yes, thanks, Kat. Well, I mean, there's no doubt we're facing a serious crisis in East Africa once again. And if we don't act quickly, this could really become a catastrophe. Anybody like me who's been working in the Horn of Africa, in East Africa for a long time, is extremely worried about what we're seeing right now. Up to 10 million people at risk, spread fairly evenly between Ethiopia, Kenya and Somalia. But we're seeing an exodus of Somali refugees into Kenya and Ethiopia at a rate of about 20,000 people a week. We're used to seeing a steady stream of refugees, a few hundred a month. But these numbers are a very different order of magnitude, frankly, the likes of which we haven't seen since the early 90s, when a million people fled the civil war that was occurring there. So the first thing I'd like to say is, you know, what's causing this? Why is this situation so different this time? Well, firstly, I mean, it's fair to say that this is a very fragile area. This is a semi-arid region where most people exist as nomadic herders. I mean, as a result, they're incredibly tough and resourceful people. They're not helpless victims. They're used to living with hardship, and they are able to survive in very inhospitable conditions, frankly, things that we can only imagine. But they've experienced one of the driest years in decades and successive failed rainy seasons. This is the third cycle of drought in a decade. In the past, there would have been one bad drought year in every dozen years or so. So there's been a prolonged period of hardship that, frankly, has exceeded their ability to cope. This has led to massive livestock losses. The people rely almost entirely on their animals. First, the goats die, then the cattle die, then the camels, and now even the giraffes have perished in East Africa. And frankly, once the animals all die, then very sadly, children are next in line. Also, global food prices, Kat, incredibly high at the moment. So food available in the markets in the region is astronomically expensive. I mean, frankly, just as it is here in the UK, this is a global problem of high food prices for bulk surpluses like grain. We can't do much about that at the moment in the short run, but it's exacerbating the problem. Also exacerbating the problem of droughts is the general global economic downturn. I mean, there are huge diasporas from these countries like Somalia, like Kenya, like Ethiopia, living around the world in the West. In the UK, here in London, there is a huge Somali community, and they send money home to support their relatives. And if they're out of work or if they've lost their job recently, as many are doing in the West and in the more wealthy countries, they're less able to send money home to their families. So this has a knock-on effect. And finally, and very importantly, in the case of Somalia, there has been chaos and conflict there for all of the last two decades, last 20 years. And more recently, this has been fueled by an aspect of the war on terror. People will have heard of Al-Shabaab. Well, this is seen as a terrorist organization, but it controls most of southern and central Somalia. And it has links to Al-Qaeda as well, suspected of. And Al-Shabaab have placed a lot of restrictions on aid into Somalia. And as a result, huge quantities of American food aid that used to go into the country up to 2 years ago have stopped now. And so in a way, that's having an exacerbating effect. So what we're seeing is people on the move, either across the borders into Ethiopia and Kenya, or moving internally towards the towns inside Somalia in search of food.
Thanks, Gareth. And Andrew, Gareth was just talking there about the Somalia exodus. I know you've just been in Dadaab on the Somalia border. When I was there a couple of weeks ago, the situation was already terrible with hundreds of people coming across the border every day. I know that since then, the number has skyrocketed. Could you tell us what you've seen on the ground, specifically in Dadaab?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's right to say there is an exodus of people leaving Somalia. I was on the road leading to the border earlier this week, and I joined a family on the final leg of their journey to the refugee camp. They hadn't eaten for days. They had no food to speak of with them. They were carrying empty water containers. There was nothing in those water containers for them to drink. And when they arrive at the camp, the sheer numbers of people turning up at the Dadaab is putting a huge strain on the resources there. The camp was only built for 90,000 people, and there's currently 370-odd thousand people in there. But the important thing to realise is that in many ways, desperate as their situation is, these people are the lucky ones. They're reaching help, they're reaching a place where they will be fed, although there are significant delays because of the huge influx of refugees in recent weeks. But across the region, there are millions of people who simply don't have enough to eat. And everywhere you go, I'm now in a place called Habaswain in northeastern Kenya, and I was in a village today where water had to be trucked to the village, and people were coming from up to almost 30 miles around to get that, sometimes walking for 2 days just to turn up and buy a 20-litre jerry can of water and take it home. So this huge population movement, as well as you know, pockets of real hunger here.
Thanks very much, Andrew. And Justin, I know that you've been spending the day in Habaswain, and I know you've met some children. Just wondering if you can talk to us about some of the children that you've met today.
Yeah, no, I'm in Wajir, which is in southern Wajir, which is part of northeast Kenya, right up on that bit near the Somalia border. And I just spent the day out with the Save the Children team. And this is really, it's not the same as Dadaab, as we've just heard from Andrew. It's not refugees coming from Somalia. This is people in Kenya, mainly of Somali origin, who are nomads. They farm their cattle, as we heard from Gareth, and they move around traditionally with the seasons. And their livelihoods are being destroyed by the drought. There's some of the elders in the community we sat down today who had walked miles actually to the place where we were meeting them. One gentleman who is 70 years old said this was the worst drought in his whole lifetime. And this was repeated to us again and again. And the consequences of that is really stark for the children. And we went to see some of the children in a hospital that was where they were referred to after they'd been identified as severely or chronically malnourished by Save the Children team. So we've got teams out in the rural areas, out in villages, sometimes mobile health clinics, sometimes nutrition where we're giving this nutritious peanut paste to children who are malnourished, sometimes extra food for the mum who's pregnant or got young children so she doesn't get malnourished. But when they identify a severely or chronically malnourished child, they get referred to this district hospital or an even bigger hospital in Wajir. And there was one little girl called Umi who I think has been filmed a few days ago, and I think it's on our website, who we've seen now a few days later. And her mum, Amina, and Umi are in this hospital, and she looks so fragile that she has a tube up her nose, and she's got a little needle in her arm, and she's being fed, and she's just beginning to come back from the brink and has put on a little bit more weight. I mean, everyone says she's getting better, but she looks so fragile, and you realize that basically those frontline Save the Children community health workers caught her literally in the nick of time, and she would be dead if she hadn't been taken to this hospital. And there are literally thousands and millions across of East Africa of children who are in this similar position, just teetering on the brink of life and death. In Somalia, many of them probably are now beginning to slip away or having to make these long treks, sometimes weeks, as Andrew has described. In Kenya, there's still time, actually, to stop a really bad situation becoming a complete catastrophe.
Thanks, Justin. It really sounds like you're seeing some very hard-hitting things down there and meeting some remarkable people. Just wonder, Gareth, you've worked in this field for many years. Heard from Justin there that some people that he met were saying that this drought was the worst in their lifetime. Can you tell us, based on your experience, what will happen next and what do we expect to see?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, we can't predict everything, but based on experience, I mean, what we do know is there's very unlikely to be any respite to the drought until October of this year at the earliest, at which point we may well get major flooding, ironically. That would not be uncommon after the drought to get floods. We had that in Kenya just a few years ago in 2006 after one of the last severe droughts. So over the next few weeks, we will probably continue to see people leave Somalia in large numbers if we can't arrest that by getting aid into the country very quickly. We will also probably start to see large concentrations of people within the major towns of Somalia, such as Baidoa. That's why aid agencies are trying to gain access to these places by negotiating with Al-Shabaab, I mean, who have said that they will lift the restrictions on aid, but it's hard to know whether to believe them or not. I mean, time will tell. As you can imagine, negotiating with these people is not a straightforward thing. Meanwhile, as Justin has said, we will rapidly scale up our operations, which in the camps where the refugees are coming, but also in Wajir, where Justin is right now, and in Ethiopia, and in those parts of Somalia where we have access today. I mean, we will push to get further inside southern Somalia as well. It's a dangerous place, but we have the experience to draw on for that, and we won't act in haste, but we will act decisively. I mean, you ask about my own experience. I started my aid career in Somalia, amazingly enough, it was 20 years ago now, and I mean, frankly, it's an unforgettable place. I am terribly worried that we will end up back there again now if we don't manage to get the access, but... I mean, I was based in Baidoa, and it became known as the City of Death, and 300,000 people died in that famine. The world responded too late, and we are not going to make the same mistake this time. As Justin says, we're in time in parts of Kenya. We saw the signs for this. We are scaling up, and equally in Ethiopia as well. But, you know, when I think about those times, and I think about being back in Baidoa, I mean, it was sort of an endless graveyard, if I'm honest with you. The only part of town that wasn't just mounds of graves was the football pitch. And I have this image in my head, which will never leave me, of every time the kids kicked the ball off the football pitch, they had to run amongst the mounds of graves to fetch the ball back. And, of course, those graves were there with their families. So it's a heartbreaking thing to watch.
And just hearing you talk about that, Gareth, you know, I'm feeling very emotional. How do you cope, and how does the team cope with seeing these kind of things on a daily basis?
You cope by doing. I mean, you cope by responding. You cope by helping people. I mean, you're not immune to the emotions. You can't stand in front of a child with a nasogastric tube in through their nose, as Justin was describing, or a drip in their arm to provide them nutrients without feeling, firstly, probably very angry. You know, that's how I always feel. And I started doing that kind of work in Somalia, and 20 years later when I visit these places, I still feel the same. It's no different. You feel angry. But you know that you can do something about it. You know you're in time. You know when Naomi reaches that centre, that with the right care, which we can provide them, they'll bounce back. So, I mean, it's you do feel the emotional side of it, but the fact that you're helping and you're there, I mean, basically it drives you on.
And Andrew, talking about being driven on and the work that we can do to help, could you just tell us a little bit about what our teams down there are doing and the kind of challenges that they're facing?
Absolutely. What we're trying to do and what we are doing is getting food, water and healthcare to these people across the region, working in some extremely difficult places. So, for example, we go out into these remote villages with mobile health teams, mobile nutrition teams to feed children who are underweight, whose health is in danger because they're not getting enough to eat. And we're hoping to scale that up so we're feeding every child as a preventative measure over the summer. We're also moving water. We've been moving water in Somalia, making sure that families in Somalia are getting clean water to drink because, of course, even if you're getting enough to eat, if you're drinking dirty water, there's all sorts of health problems that can stem from that. And finally, for people who do develop these health problems, they need good medical care, and families absolutely need to have access to medicine and to doctors. And so we're working with mobile health teams, outreach projects into these remote communities. It's not just the refugee camps, it's across the region in these remote communities, making sure that people have everything. And we're not just playing the short game either. We're looking at the bigger picture here. This is, drought is becoming more common in this part of the world. So we're working with the communities to find ways to make them more resilient to drought. So, for example, we're trying to engage local traders and local businessmen and food producers to deliver food aid. So we're not setting up in parallel to the local economy and distributing food aid. We're using those traders and we're using those food producers who can grow the little they can grow to make sure that they're not being sort of priced out of the market by the fact that there's food aid arriving in some parts of of Kenya and Ethiopia and Somalia. So we're working across the board. We're also working in the refugee camp to identify very vulnerable children who have made this journey. Some of them turn up on their own. They've lost their parents along the way. I sat with a boy whose mother died on the way the other day, and he was absolutely heartbroken. He had to walk on. He had to make his way to Dadaab. And when he arrived, say the children were there, and we were able to place him in a foster home. And that's not going to be a replacement for his mother, but at least he's in a family environment. At least he's not alone. At least he's not, scrimping for survival in one of the most dangerous parts of the world. Children are so vulnerable when they're separated, especially in conflict zones, especially when there's not enough to eat, and especially when they don't know where they are and they're just walking desperate, looking for that their last hope, this refugee camp, the place they can get some food. And when they arrive, they're often in a very, very, malnourished and poor condition. So we're working really hard to make sure those vulnerable children are looked after as well.
It does sound like our teams there are doing a fantastic job. We asked our listeners to submit some questions. Sadly, we've only got time for a few of them. So I'm going to kick off with one for you, Gareth, if that's okay. How do you think that this terrible situation compares with the Ethiopian famine in 1984?
Well, none of us obviously can forget where we were on the day of we saw those pictures of Michael Burke in Ethiopia in 84. And I would say, well, I don't think it's by any means as bad as that yet. And a lot has been done in the intervening years in Ethiopia to build the safety nets and the early warning systems and adapt the way aid is given there to head off those kind of, cataclysmic, biblically bad problems. And I think we will have truly failed if we see that happening again in Ethiopia. And to be honest, therefore, I'm less worried. As a humanitarian director, I have to actually prioritise across these different settings. And whilst there's a large number of people affected in Ethiopia, I'm less worried in the scale of things about Ethiopia. I'm mostly worried about Somalia, where where Justin is in Kenya, we are able to respond, and we are responding. But there are big parts of Somalia where we just can't go right now. And if we're not able to act quickly, my deepest fear is that we'll see an unimaginable tragedy unfold as it did 20 years ago. And we simply have to do everything in our power to avoid that.
And following on from that, a lot of us have heard the media saying that we aid agencies are exaggerating. Hearing from both you, Justin, and you, Andrew, I know that we're not. But what would you say to that accusation that we are exaggerating?
Well, I think journalists...
Sorry, Andrew, could you answer that one?
Yeah, sure. I think journalists' job is to be sceptical. But every single journalist that I've met here have come in, they're sceptical. They've left absolutely convinced of the needs of these people. They come here and they're totally free to report. And we've all seen the reports on the television over the last week. We've all read the newspapers. The journalists that are here are in no doubt of the scale of the problem. It's the journalists that are sitting at home writing columns and who are saying that we're exaggerating and, we're doing it because we need money or whatever. There is no doubt. And any journalist is welcome to come here, and I'm utterly convinced that they will leave. If that's what they believe when they come here, they will leave with a different perspective. You've only got to sit down and talk to a family who have walked for, in some cases, months to get some sort of help and hear the horrors they faced along the way, being attacked by wild animals, being robbed by bandits, being raped, arriving at a camp starving, desperate for food. And it's a hard-hearted journalist who listens to those stories in such number. They're not hard to find. You don't have to look very hard to find a story like that. You just go to the reception centre every morning and 1,000 new people have arrived. So any journalist is welcome to come here and have a look and make their own mind up. I know every journalist who has been here has made their own mind up, and they unequivocally have come out and reported that there is an extremely serious crisis unfolding in this part of the world. Those that don't believe that, well, I suggest they jump on a plane to Nairobi and join the convoy and come up and have a look and then do their reporting. But I'm utterly confident to the core. The things that I've seen over the past couple of weeks and the things I've shown journalists over the past couple of weeks, there is no doubt in my mind that this is such a serious situation. and the media reportage from here has reflected that.
Absolutely, and clearly something we all feel passionate about. Justin, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, just to say that I mean, it's clearly very serious. I mean, it's the worst, as Gareth says, in Somalia, and it's worse there because of the conflict and very poor governance, and that's what we've seen again and again in history, is when you get that combination of drought, but even more than that, the conflict and the bad governance then tips people over the edge. And I think on top of that, we now have high food prices and climate change, and it's that deadly mix which is really coming together in East Africa and pushing people to the edge. I think the trouble is we have a humanitarian system which usually responds too late when it's on our television screens and people are dying, because that's what triggers it. And we've got to move to a humanitarian system that moves earlier and prevents it getting to that stage, which actually is cheaper and more efficient, but more importantly, saves more lives that might not look so dramatic on our television screens. But we don't have that at the moment, and we've got to reform the way we respond to these big emergencies, which are increasingly going to happen. We've had 40 in the last year. The only thing I'd add, though, Kat, is that, I mean, and I think Gareth was getting at this. This is a deadly, difficult situation for 10 million people in the Horn of Africa. But the other criticism we get is that it's kind of painting a bad picture of Africa. And I don't think we should apologize for speaking up about the horrific humanitarian situation in the whole of Africa. But as Gareth said, we should also point in a number of places in Africa and as the continent as a whole to the huge strides forward. One of the very interesting things is that we've made this massive acceleration in reducing child deaths in the world in the last 10 years, and actually we're accelerating progress in reducing deaths from illnesses through vaccinations, through better health systems, and that's real progress. But that doesn't take away from here and now in the Horn of Africa, in Ethiopia, particularly in Somalia and northern Kenya, we have a humanitarian situation, and the job of Save the Children, and we're there on the front line, as Gareth has described, even in the difficult places like in the south and central part of Somalia, is to save children's lives. But at the same time, we've worked with these communities often for decades, and we're addressing some of these underlying causes. Now, in the very tough places, that's hard to do, and sometimes we are just saving lives, and we should be proud of that. Our staff are doing an amazing job. In other places where there's more space, we are also trying to make sure that we're boosting the long-term coping mechanisms and resilience of the community. As Andrew said, we've got very innovative schemes which are about boosting the local markets. Rather than giving food aid, we're giving vouchers which people give to local traders, which boosts the local economy. But we're also involved in trying to push for reform in a number of these countries to address some of the bigger issues. And at a global level, we're also pressing for changes that will mean that we get less of this kind of less of these very severe humanitarian situations and better and earlier responses. So I think Save the Children needs to work at all of these different levels, but but the humanitarian imperative should be the first priority for us. And one of the things I feel as CEO here this week is enormously proud, and I want to thank the people on the call for their support, because in a way we wouldn't be able to do this, and the staff I've met today wouldn't be able to do this work without that support. I feel enormously proud for these frontline Save the Children workers. They are the heroes of Save the Children, the people out there in the village that Andrew and I were today, making sure that children who have severe malnutrition are saved, the people helping with water, the people doing protection in these camps where kids have been separated from their family and need to be fostered or looked after, especially because they've walked for days by themselves. These are amazing people doing completely extraordinary jobs, and I think they really make me proud of what Save the Children's doing. And I think, I don't know, it's very hard to bottle that and communicate it. But if you had a chance, anybody on the call, to meet some of these people, you would be very proud too.
Thank you very much, Justin. We are now running out of time, so I'm just going to hand over to Gareth for his closing thoughts before we wrap up the call.
Well, I just want to add to what's been said there by Justin and Andrew. Yeah, there's a saying in humanitarian work that that your greatest enemy is despair. And this is not a, this is by no means an utterly hopeless situation. Remember, these are tough and resourceful people we're dealing with here. And the kids amazingly bounce back in a few days if we reach them in time. I mean, I've been involved in treating children who are starving like Umi for 20 years. And I've lost count of the number of kids who I thought when I first saw them, they have absolutely no chance of surviving. And you know what? Within no time, they are running around causing trouble as young kids should be. And this is why we do this work. Do not give up on these people. You're on this call. That means you care. And I, for one, am truly grateful to you on behalf of all those young African lives that we are going to save. They are depending on us, folks. Let's do this.
Thank you very much, Gareth. Thank you, Justin, and thank you, Andrew. And most importantly, thank you, everyone, for joining us on this call. For more information, please do visit our website, www.savethechildren.org.uk. Thank you.